And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We hope to be speaking live with U.S. Representative Steve King in just a few moments. Having a little bit of a trouble reaching him in Washington, but hopefully Steve King will be joining us in just a few minutes. Until that time, Charity Nebbe joins me, host of Talk of Iowa. And Charity, thanks for coming in. We're going to use the time here before we talk to Representative King to talk about an exciting new podcast here at Iowa Public Radio called Lit City that you're involved in. Tell us
about
it.
Well, as you know, we've rolled out a new podcast just recently, Under the Golden Dome, all about legislative issues. This is another new podcast effort, and as you said, it's called Lit City. And, of course, what city in the United States of America is the only UNESCO City of Literature?
I know.
So Iowa City,
exactly.
Of course. And as you know, on Talk of Iowa, I do a lot of interviews with authors. So this is an opportunity for us to use some of those interviews that I've done with authors and put them together in a new way. I'm working on it with Anna Williams, and she's a graduate student at the University of Iowa. She and I are doing this podcast together, and we'll be featuring a lot of the interviews that I've done with authors in the past. The very first episode is up and ready, and it's an interview that I did with the author Nathan Hill, who grew up in Cedar Rapids, and his novel, The Nix, came out last year. A really big hit, fascinating book. So he's in the first episode of Lit City, and we're also doing some other fun things surrounding the interview. So on the second episode of Lit City, we're going to find out a little bit more about the history of the Writers Workshop program as well. And it's up on Iowa Public Radio, Google Play, iTunes. It should be a lot of fun.
Okay. Thank you, Charity Nebbe. Lit City is the title of our podcast. You can check out our website, iowapublicradio.org. Thanks, Charity Nebbe. We have now contact with Steve King. And now that we're well into the new congressional session, we have extended invitations to all six members of our congressional delegation in Washington. Today, we're joined by the longest-serving current representative from Iowa, Steve King. In November, he was easily reelected to represent Iowa's 4th District. That's in the northwest and central part of the state, including the city of Ames, Mason City, as well as Sioux City, Boone, Fort Dodge. The outspoken fiscal and social conservative is now in his 8th term in Congress. And Representative King, so happy to welcome you once again on our show.
Well, thanks so much. Sorry it took a little while to get connected here today, but as you said, it is busy in this town now. A lot is going on in Washington.
That is a sure thing. Let's talk a little bit about what happened last night. Get your reflections on that. President Trump's national security advisor, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, resigned last night, evidently because of his lack of discretion, misleading the vice president about the nature of his exchanges with the Russian ambassador before Trump became president, and allegedly opening himself up to blackmail by the Russians. How problematic do you see this for this administration in its early days, that he was forced to resign only days after becoming national security advisor?
Yeah, something like 25 days into this new administration, which is the quickest turnaround of any national security advisor. I very much regret that this happened. I'm one who I've known General Flynn for a number of years and been impressed by him. I've had him as a guest speaker before a breakfast that I host on Wednesday mornings here for other members, and dealt with him along the campaign trail quite a lot. And so I want to thank General Flynn for his service to our country, his decades of service in the military, and the stellar career that he had. And I wonder sometimes if the military career doesn't prepare one well for the political arena. But I don't know what was said in the telephone conversations, and I can't imagine what would leave him exposed to blackmail. I don't know of nothing of that nature, but perhaps we'll find out in the next few days.
Mm-hmm. There are calls now, plenty of calls, especially from Democrats, for an investigation into these discussions with the Russian. National security is first and foremost the highest priority of any president. Would you be behind support for an independent investigation of what happened?
Well, I think first I understand that there's a transcript of the conversation that has been either leaked or reviewed by others, and I'd like to see that transcript if that's something that has been public or will be made public. I'd like to understand the chronology of what took place, generally what was said, specifically if we can find out. Before I'd answer a question to that, I want to make sure I'd be informed. And another thing is that Somebody else can make the case on why he might be vulnerable for blackmail. I've just heard that today for the first time.
Right.
But whether or not that's the case, I think that for the Trump administration, get this done and move on.
Isn't that the
point? Can't let it stop your rhythm.
Right, Congressman. Though, isn't that the point of an investigation? You've raised a number of questions that you have, that others have. The investigation is there to answer those questions. So, isn't it time for an independent investigation?
Well, independence, that's a great big ask, an independent investigation. We didn't have one of those on Hillary Clinton, I might remind people. But it is true that the chairman of the House Select Committee on Intelligence, Devin Nunes, has said that he will open an investigation into this. One of the reasons is to find out how this information that otherwise should have been, I don't know if I want to describe it classified, but private, has been so quickly leaked to the press. And it looks like there are a number of people that might be responsible for that. If those kind of things leak out in that fashion, rather than let's just presume this. Let's just say that you are in the intelligence community serving our country and you come across this information. Would you leak it to the press or would you take it to the president?
Right.
It looks like they leaked it to the press.
Doesn't that raise questions, though, about the people Donald Trump has surrounded himself with if he has such a leaky core group of people?
Well, that's a legitimate question, and it's one I would like to examine. But it might be true that these people have surrounded him instead. Mm-hmm. If they were there before he took office, and likely they were, then they probably have a different agenda. I would say that in my background, I've received a fair number of classified briefings along the way. I can think of one in particular that was 180 degrees off of the president's foreign policy position, delivered in a foreign country in a way designed to shift the opinions of a room full of members of Congress, when I heard that, I realized the intelligence community isn't all on the same page, and it can get very messy when you dig into that.
Representative King, zooming out a little bit, looking at the 24 days of the Trump presidency, have these first few weeks of the Trump administration given you more or less confidence that Donald Trump can lead our nation?
Well, I think the appointments, and I'll say in this case with General Flynn, I've got to say General Flynn notwithstanding, the appointments he has in his cabinet and the top appointments that he's made and the deputies that are there, I'm very, very impressed with those appointments. They're all doers. They're all people that take charge. So I'm very much encouraged by that. I'm encouraged by the string of executive orders that he rolled out that it looks like he's working off a list of these are my promises, I'm going to keep them, and there are some things out there that aren't yet done. But there's been a couple hiccups along the way. One of them was the rollout of his policy on the seven countries from the Middle East, and that could have been smoother. But I don't know that it was as big a deal as the press made it out to be. And now that we're in before the courts, I'm looking at the courts as being a big problem right now. So I think on balance, I give him a really good grade to launch this. And there are enemies out there that are trying to knock him off the rails, and he's going to have to hang on and keep going forward. It's hard to do, but I think Donald Trump's got the personality and the determination to keep moving forward.
You mentioned that you're very pleased with all the executive orders issued by this president. I believe about a dozen. They come out very fast, of course. But in 2014, you advocated that Republicans take a serious look at impeaching President Obama because of one of his executive orders, DACA. You argued that Obama's use of executive orders was unconstitutional. Now, how is that different, just generally speaking, the use of executive orders by this president, that you praise them, and by the previous president, you say it's unconstitutional?
Well, first of all, I never labeled an executive order as being unconstitutional by virtue of it being an executive order. And in fact, the DACA policies that are there, those that are rolled out by the Secretary of Homeland Security, it started out with Janet Napolitano. And those I call them executive edicts, so I go broader than a specific executive order. But Janet Napolitano wrote those in a way to try to make the argument that they were constitutional. But all along, Barack Obama himself argued that he did not have the authority to do DACA. There are 22 times he's on videotape giving that speech, and in some cases a lecture. But I think he calculated that he could get away with it politically, and so far he has. So you look at the executive order, and does he have the authority or doesn't he have? Does the president have the authority or doesn't he have the authority? And that's what you determine upon, and it may be unconstitutional, and it may be illegal, but we need to evaluate each one of them based upon the Constitution and current law.
So good to have Steve King, Congressman of Iowa's 4th District, with us for another few minutes. He joined us a little bit late. We have about 10 minutes left. Let's make sure we get in a call or two here. David in Davenport, welcome to our program, and your question for Congressman King.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, David, welcome to the program. You're on the air. We can hear you.
Thanks for having me. Congressman King, I would expect you to defend the president on party lines as much as humanly possible. But my question to you would be, at what point are these alternative facts or untruths even too much for you? And I'll take my answer offline.
When you say even too much for me, I think there's an implication you put in there, David. But I do care about the truth and the objective truth, and sometimes I'll give a different viewpoint on some things just to bring it back to a perspective. And for example, I think the one that was the topic of alternative facts, that being a new term in our political dialogue here, had to do with how many fraudulent votes that there have been cast in the United States. And the others on the other side of that argument argue essentially none or virtually none. And I have dug into that issue deeply for the span ever since the 2000 election, and when I found myself in a position of responsibility where I had to know those things. And I've been convinced that there are substantially more fraudulent or illegal votes cast in the country than you can find, at least within the easily available media. And I don't know whether Donald Trump's number is right.
Yeah, Donald Trump is saying 3 to 5 million. That's way past the handful of possibly fraudulent votes that have been recorded.
That's the consensus, I think, that you've described of what is, I call them, the easily available media. But on the other hand, John Fund has written a book on this. There are a number of other cases. But the thing that comes to mind for me, there are 8 jurisdictions in Virginia where they surveyed the voters on an exit poll, as I recall. And out of that, they ask, are you a citizen of the United States? And did you vote? And they would answer was yes. Are you a citizen of the United States? And 1,046 said no. That's 8 jurisdictions in Virginia. That's one of the examples. There are other universities that have gone together to do some broader polling that indicates those numbers grow. I did one calculation out of this that came to 2.4 million. Of course, it's all extrapolation, just like our surveys and polls are. And another calculation that came to around 900,000. I think that Donald Trump, he's got a number bigger than anybody else.
Voter fraud is a serious problem. Why not call for an investigation? This is the very basis of our democracy. Are you calling for an investigation if you believe there is so much voter fraud that the popular vote was thrown off? It is in favor of Hillary Clinton, even though she did not win the Electoral College vote. Calling for an investigation?
Donald Trump has called for an investigation, and he's assigned Vice President Pence to head that up. So I don't think that I need to. I do think that we need to get America better informed with this, and I don't think that Hillary Clinton's votes and the popular vote that I concede that she won the popular vote. I don't take issue with that, but
okay,
I believe there are other races that may have been decided by illegal votes in the past. And I think we need to have the maximum amount of integrity in our electoral process. If we ever lose confidence in our electoral process, our Constitution itself will fall.
Okay. We have very little time left. We wanted to get at least one caller from your district, Congressman King. This is Lisa in Ames. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I'm a metastatic breast cancer patient. And I'm very concerned about your plan to repeal the ACA, especially considering that you're willing to repeal it without having a replacement available. And I definitely benefit from the fact that there's no more lifetime limit cap for insurance, that's not allowed, because my treatment is extremely expensive. And I mean, my family will face bankruptcy and then in a short time, like in a number of years, if that's not available to us anymore.
Okay, Lisa.
Well, thanks, Ben and Lisa. I appreciate you calling in. And and providing this opportunity to clarify this. What I've said as my desire to repeal Obamacare, which I have brought the first draft to repeal it in the very first day that it passed, and I've pushed that ever since. I'm committed to that. But I'm encouraging my colleagues, saying it's not that I want to repeal Obamacare and replace it with nothing. It's what I have said is that if that's all we did, on balance, Americans will be better off. Now, I have every commitment to follow through and put replacement components in there. And we had a meeting and discussion on that this morning. I'm going to a meeting as soon as I hang up the phone here, and there'll be another one another hour later and another one on Thursday. So I'm working with the replacement team here in Congress. But it was to make the point that Obamacare itself is unsustainable, and we're going to end up with lots of people that don't have their own health insurance if we just allow it to continue down the path it is.
But if there was a bill out there, and this you said you've introduced it, to repeal and there would be no replacement, you would be in favor of doing that today or tomorrow?
And I would continue my work to put the replacements into law.
What do you tell, though, the people who depend on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, 230,000 Iowans, including 25,000 children, according to a latest Iowa Policy Project report? What do you tell them in the meantime when that coverage is not there?
Well, they canceled my Obamacare insurance last September 28, effective December 31st. That's roughly a 90-day heads up that I'm going to be without insurance. And I have found a policy to replace it, but there's only one available to me. And that's true for at least a third of the country. And so we can't go down that path. And rather than talking numbers, let's talk about percentages. So right now you have about 11.1 million people that are receiving a premium subsidy. And that would end if we repealed Obamacare as it is. But it's around 98%. It's 98.3% of their premiums are being paid, and that's a group of people that would be have to have an access to a free marketplace too. We want to make sure we get the insurance companies to compete. The big insurance companies in the country, the top four, have said they're going to pull completely out of Obamacare. We need them competing and writing policies that meet the demands and choices of the consumers. And I'm thankful that Lisa is covered now, and we want to do all we can to keep as many people covered as possible. But we are never going to let people go without health care. And we get mixed up in that dialogue, the difference between health care and health insurance. And if those terms have been conflated over the last, say, 10 years or more for the purpose of pushing this Obamacare legislation, which I think everybody now admits is a big mistake for our country, and we have to fix it.
Steve King, we have just a few minutes left. I wanted to run this by you. I'm sure you saw this news yesterday that Mexico, related to us in Iowa as an agricultural state, Mexico is ready to hit the U.S. where it hurts, and Iowa especially where it hurts, in corn exports. Mexico, one of the top buyers of America corn in the world. Of course, Iowa, big corn-producing state. In response to Donald Trump's threats against Mexico, a Mexican senator who leads a congressional committee on foreign relations says he's introducing a bill this week where Mexico will buy corn from Brazil and Argentina instead of the U.S. How concerned are you that Iowa farmers will, in a certain way, lose out on this huge Mexican export market for our corn at perhaps the beginning of a trade war?
Well, it's one senator with one bill, but it's, I don't like the sound of it at all. And I recall going through that on fructose in the past, and we had to litigate that against Mexico as I'm locking our products out in an effort to protect their producers in Mexico. So we had the threat then of a trade war beginning. But I would say to if this message echoes down to the senator in Mexico, or as we talk about it, this talk about a 20% duty on products coming in from Mexico, that will never fly. That's something like a $54 billion a year duty, and it's just me doing the math on the back of an envelope, but it's in the zone. And that will, no one's going to go for that here in this Congress. We don't want to start a trade war. We have a majority of people here that want to be free and smart traders. And I don't think that's going to happen at all. And so my message to the senator is, okay, we all ought to take a deep breath here and not overreact. And maybe he's just sending a message. If he is, we get the message.
Okay. In the minute or so we have left, I would like to have you react to the protests we've seen across the country in the first few weeks of the Trump administration. The Women's March, of course, at the beginning. Also, thousands of local groups being formed in the first weeks of this presidency. Many very upset about Donald Trump's actions, those protests at airports against his travel ban. How would you see these protesters and these protests? They are being compared to the Tea Party uprising, I guess, if you can put it that way, in 2009. Do you see the similarity?
Well, I thought they were the exact diametric political opposite of the Tea Parties, by the way. But, you know, I've met a fair number of them, and it looks like we're going to have protests every weekend until the public pushes back on it or the organizers decide they don't get a political benefit from it or perhaps they run out of money. But I met with a lot of the people in the Women's March that Saturday after the inauguration, so that would have been January 21st. And the city out here in Washington was full of primarily women, maybe 80 or 90% women, wearing pink. And I went into the McDonald's restaurant that was full of women in pink, and I had a whole long series of conversations before I was able to leave. And so I got a good flavor of that. Some of it flown in from Arizona, ridden bus for 20 hours. And it looks to me like George Soros is funding this, and it's got the support of President Obama. So I think they should have given President Trump an opportunity and still should give him that opportunity to get his presidency up and running. The people have spoken, and step back, take a deep breath again, and I remind them that Barack Obama's told us 8 years ago elections have consequences.
Okay, thank you very much. We've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 4th District. Always good to have you on, Congressman. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll look at that resignation of Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor, the demand by Democrats for new investigations into Flynn's pre-inauguration talks with Russia. Wayne Morial will join us of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, also Mary McCarthy of Drake University on President Trump's challenges in Asia. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury with help from Anna Williams. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.